This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. A special group of would-be lawmakers will be invading the State House in less than 2 weeks. They are participants in the first-ever Legathon. The workshop invites interested people to help shape model legislation that would help Vermont's economy grow, and it's specifically targeted at supporting technology-based businesses. And the Legathoners will be learning about how a good idea goes through the process from conception to codification. Vermont Speaker of the House and Senate President Pro Tem will participate, and our guest today, Vermont Law School Professor Oliver Goodenough, is hosting the event. Professor Goodenough joins us now to help us gather your suggestions for what could be a law and to answer questions about how the process works. You can share yours by calling 1-800-639-2211. Our number again, 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your suggestions for a law that you think would help Vermont's economy grow, would be good for business, maybe a law that you'd like to see repealed. Go to vpr.net and click on Vermont Edition. Professor Goodenough, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
All right. So first of all, what made you think the Legathon would be a good idea?
Well, it grows out of two or three things put together. One of them is that over time I've been lucky to be sometimes asked by the legislative committees, the Senate and the House committees on economic development, for some ideas. What could we do in this area? I teach business law, nonprofit law, and at Vermont Law School, also at Dartmouth and at UVM's business school. And so I was presenting some thoughts about this. And last fall, I'd also gone to a startup weekend, one of these two or three-day events that are along with hackathons, where folks come together and cook good ideas, come out with something specific at the end. And the thought of putting that all together just kind of came together so that the approach of doing this intensive startup hackathon-style approach but to legislation, hence a legathon.
And who do you think is going to come to this?
Oh, we're hopeful that we'll get a very broad swath of folks, students, young graduates, emerging professionals, seasoned professionals. We really are hoping for a broad set of folks coming, folks across a variety of political, the whole political spectrum. It's really very open.
And so if people are interested, can they still do it or have you closed the
absolutely
registration?
No. The registration's open. VTLegathon.org. VTLegathon with an I. There you go. You can find the information, and we'd appreciate anybody who's interested. Go have a look. If it interests you, we still have space.
You know, I would think, though, that some people find, you know, the idea of lawmaking – I mean – some people may find it a little intimidating, the actual idea of getting together with all these smart people you just mentioned, people who have either expertise or interest in certain fields. But if people are just curious, how does a lawmaking process work? How does a lawmaker do his or her job? I mean, that seems like enough of a reason to do something like this.
Absolutely. We're really hoping it will be educational as a first and foremost. And so folks can learn about that, but learn by doing. One of the things that's interesting, I think most of us when we start in on this think, oh, just a law. Law can happen. Boom. It's all set. What it really depends on, though, is taking what seems like a good idea and then running it through all of the considerations. What are the unintended consequences? What are the opposing interests? How's it going to balance out? Sometimes a law is about a good versus a bad thing, and those are easy laws. The hard laws are when you've got competing goods, or even worse, competing bads. You know, what's the best of two bad outcomes we can hope for? And those are the ones where the kind of deliberation and multi-party input that we are hoping for in this event make a big difference.
We're going to get people sharing their ideas for laws. I'll read you some that have come in already. Erica in Barrie says it would be great to see more enforcement of the Americans with Disabilities Act. Many times it's hard to go shopping in stores because the aisles are filled with displays. The stores have stairs going into the entryways so the people using walkers or wheelchairs can't get in. Lisa says, I'd make a law to prohibit able-bodied people from parking in a handicapped parking space because they've borrowed someone's car. Nelson says, I'd love to see a law that creates an animal abuse registry, similar to a sex offender registry. This would prevent them from owning animals, caring for animals, etc. There are several states that are currently debating this type of action, and Nelson got quite a few people saying, here, they support that idea for a law. And Luz says, La salud más económica, which I think she means make healthcare more affordable. So how do you make a law to do that? It's a sort of a broad idea of a law. Certainly a lot of lawmakers trying to work on that at the moment. And if you have a law that you would like to create, call 1-800-639-2211. 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your law at vpr.net/Vermont Edition. Or maybe you just have a question for Oliver Goodenough about how does a law actually become one? You know, how does it go from an idea to the governor's desk? We're talking about that today, and we're going to talk through some of your laws. More on the legathon, though, Professor Goodenough. You've got listed on the website that House Speaker Shap Smith is going to be there, Senate President Pro Tem John Campbell is going to be there. Are you actually thinking that people will be creating a mock law or proposed legislation that will be actually taken up by the legislature in January?
Well, there's no obligation for the legislature to do any of that. This is not an official, proposed legislation for the legislature. But we've been very lucky that whether it's the Speaker's House, the President, Speaker's Office, the President Pro Tem, they've all been generous with their time. They're allowing us to have the event in the State House. So, in fact, we're going to be in the committee rooms. We're going to be in the chambers. It's going to be a great deal of verisimilitude that comes from all of that. There's also going to be coaches. Many of the House and Senate members will be on the coaching team, although we'll also have folks from business and from lobbyists and a broad spectrum there as well. So it's the primary purpose is the education piece. If some good ideas come out of it, fabulous. We're going to publish them all. We're going to put all the proposals together in a book kind of format and have them on the web and be available both here in Vermont and across the country.
You say that you're working on drafting model legislation in this event that would, quote, foster economic development, particularly development involving innovative technology, but which will not require significant public expenditure or subsidy, and which will respect the general good of society. Why are you looking specifically at tech innovation?
Well, part of it is just avoiding, as they say, boiling the ocean. You know, we could have great ideas. Some of the things that have come in already have been great ideas, but not necessarily for this kind of approach. Vermont is astonishingly already a bit of a tech leader. This may come as a surprise to people, but when Forbes did a list of the most innovative tech hubs in the United States, Burlington area turns out to be number 9 and the highest ranked east of the Mississippi, just ahead of Boston. So we actually outrank Boston as a tech hub, at least in that one survey. So we are already partly there. And obviously, good jobs with low impact on the environment is the cool goal we're all trying to find. And supporting that kind of economy, I think, gets very broad support across all of the different parties, all of the different segments. If we can find a way to increase that kind of job and that kind of economic activity, that's a pretty good idea. We're already partly way there. If our legal structure can make us more attractive and we can climb up a bit from 9 to 7 to 10, you know, to whatever, that would be a good deal.
Well, I think particularly the part two where you say that will not require a large public subsidy is probably also appealing to many people.
Exactly. One of the things that people don't often understand is that our legal structure is a part of what we might call an ecosystem of innovation and of entrepreneurship. And that ecosystem consists of all kinds of things, including everything from healthcare that's available, but also do we have decent laws for nonprofits, for businesses? And then Vermont is actually a leader in the mixture of the two in the social enterprise field. So there's the laws that make that possible are important. Laws that might make it possible to develop the first official robot law. Cool. These are things that are developing. If we could provide a legal landscape that enabled that to some degree, we would increase our chances of being a center for the development of those projects.
We're going to get into some of the ideas, some of the laws that our listeners would like to create or wish that they could create. And in doing so, I think we'll also get into some of the challenges with making a law, some of the potential unintended consequences, or how lawmakers actually work to try to figure out what a law is actually going to do once it's put into practice. We got a note from Haiti who suggests bring back the Amazon affiliate program to Vermont bloggers. And we should just back up and say in January of 2015, Amazon notified associates in Vermont and 5 other states that they were going to be terminated due to Vermont income tax law or tax law. Associates who are bloggers and others basically earned money by referring customers to the Amazon website. And the legislation in question passed several years ago in 2011, and it would apply sales tax laws to companies such as Amazon that solicit businesses through customer referral agreements with Vermont not residents. Okay, so what about the idea of bringing the Amazon affiliate program back to Vermont?
Well, a brief familial disclaimer, because I should mention that although I'm not a legislator myself, I am lucky enough to be married to a legislator, Allison Clarkson, who represents Plymouth, Reading, and Woodstock. And she is, in fact, a member of the House Ways and Means Committee, which develops our tax policy. This is, again, one of those hard questions of the conflict of goods. Because places like Amazon, if they are tax-free selling into Vermont, really get a leg up on our local merchants. Our local merchants pay our sales tax. It's a piece of how we raise the money we need to run the state. We can debate back and forth about rates, but you know, there we are. We have that as a law. If a big company like Amazon and its affiliates can avoid some of that, we're giving them a leg up. Now, obviously, every time there is a tax on something, that often is a discouragement for that activity. So you put it in, and then we get a discouragement. Amazon, for whatever reason, felt that it wanted to try and make a return statement and said, no, we're going to pull out of some of that. So it's one of those problems where you've got competing goods. You want our folks to be able to participate with Amazon. You want a level playing field for our local merchants. Those two come into clash, and it's exactly that, you know, working out the priorities when you get clashing goods that is a piece of the classic legislative process.
It's impossible, though, not in this specific case, but it's impossible in any law to try to anticipate every single potential pitfall, potential conflict of interest, potential problem that you've created with the law, unintended consequence, or the loopholes. But it's part of the job of lawmakers to do that. I mean, that's what we elect them for, is to create good laws, not laws that further encumber people. So, I mean, it just seems...
Well, the committee process is the place where a bunch of this is supposed to be hashed out. The law gets introduced. It then gets referred to a particular committee as its starting point. And it's the small group of the committee that takes the time to have hearings, to take testimony, to be open to the public. These are all open to the public in Vermont, to get people to come in and try and tell them, oh, by the way, have you thought of? Because that's even something extremely well-intentioned doesn't necessarily get all the ramifications thought of. So that the process is imperfect, but it's intended at least to surface those kind of concerns.
Do you think people know that? I mean, is that part of the idea here behind the legathon that, you know, you discover it's actually more difficult than perhaps we think?
Absolutely. And in fact, the legathon goes from the 13th to the 15th of November, partly taking some time all day Saturday, basically allocated to developing the projects into legal proposals. But the point of having that much time is it's not just, oh, gee, this would be a cool thing, let's do it, but really to develop a report on what those kinds of consequences could look like. So, yes, absolutely, that's part of this process, as it is, I think, for a good legislative process generally.
Talking about laws, how they're made, and what law you'd like to pass, if you could pass any law. We got one from Max in the Northeast Kingdom who says, here's an idea, headlights on when it's foggy. I can't tell you how many mornings I see vehicles full of dull color going about their way as though no other driver might be interested in being aware of their presence. The retort I often hear is that, well, headlights don't help me see in the fog. Max says, sometimes you just can't help stupid. Brenna would like to ban leg hold trapping. She says it's decimating our wildlife. The Conservative American Veterinary Medical Association opposes the use of leg hold trapping because they inflict prolonged suffering and are indiscriminate. And let's go to Bruce, calling in from Hinesburg. Hi, Bruce. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. Thank you. I have been a legislative advocate for quite some time, about 40 years of my life. Started doing this as a form of community service. Today, I'm working on three bills that I have succeeded in persuading legislators to get introduced in the legislature. They are in committee right now. One of them addresses vulnerable user safety on Vermont roads. That's people are using the roads who are not in motor vehicles, and that's H-231, which is in committee. Another one is about preventing youth drug addiction, and it's a follow-up to a law that I got passed in 1997, which set the standard in Vermont for preventing sales of tobacco products to youth, but it needs improvement because it hasn't been obeyed by the Department of Liquor Control. The other bill that I am trying to get passed to solve a significant Vermont problem is about a unconstitutional injustice that affects about 10% of Vermont's population every year, and that's the 8% penalty for late payment of property taxes, called delinquent property taxes. It's a law that punishes people who have done nothing wrong and violates both the Vermont and the federal constitutions. I think we're at a very advantageous position as citizens in Vermont because of the size of the state and the accessibility of legislators to work effectively with the whole legislative process.
Bruce, let me ask you, you've got three bills here that you're really have been and are working very hard to see passed. So clearly this is something that's a passion for you. Why not be a legislator? Why not run and be a legislator? Why are you working as a sort of a citizen activist instead?
Well, I have run for the legislature. The first time I ran for the House was I was opposing Bill Lippert in his first election, but Bill and I got together and realized that we were so much the same that most of the voters were going to vote for one or the other of us, or possibly a third candidate, who if we didn't give full attention to one of us, he might get more votes than either one of us. So I dropped out of the race and supported Bill. Then I ran five times for the Vermont Senate for Chittenden County, which is an electoral zoo, and I ran as an independent. And if you run as an independent for the Senate in Chittenden County, you have no chance of winning. I did it because it was worth a shot. I did run as a Democrat one time and got 12,000 votes when I usually got 5,000 votes running as an independent on my own. But I have toyed with an idea, but not because I think I would make a good legislator, but just haven't done that. I'm at a point in my life right now where I'm not going to try again because I'm taking my retirement seriously now.
Well, Bruce, thank you for calling in and for sharing your perspective. Professor Goodenough, what about, I mean, Bruce, we have a citizen legislature is what we're calling them. But here's Bruce, who is an actual citizen, not a legislator, but who is doing this work of being an activist, really making sure that he shepherds the legislation that he cares about most through the process.
Well, one of the things that his comment makes clear is that actually, having legislative language is a very important step in making any of this happen. We all of us have these, you know, gee, we'd like to see X happen. But to turn X into a law requires people to state it in legal terms. Now, lawyers sometimes criticize that it's hard to understand. I will take that criticism on board. But the point of it is to have a clear statement in a way that is unambiguous about the things that are supposed to be enabled or made illegal or whatever it is the law is doing. And so if you are a citizen who's interested in working on a project like this and seeing if your passion can become something that would be enacted, it can be quite helpful to propose specific language. Now, that said, the Legislative Council Office in the legislature are professionals at this. They're probably going to do a better job. Don't get too wedded to the language you're actually putting on the table. But having a specific proposal rather than just a general, gee, wouldn't it be better if we all did something better? That doesn't become a law. A law it needs to have a specific focus. So,
but isn't that what we have lawmakers for? You know, I as a constituent say, hey, I want you to fix this, and then my lawmaker is supposed to put that into legalese and go fix it.
I agree, and they often do that. But if you go to the same legislature and say legalese, and by the way, here is something, you've just done a piece of their homework. As a teacher, if my students can have a piece of their homework done for them, they get on it faster and better.
We're talking with Oliver Goodenough. He's helping to run the Legathon at the State House later this month. Participants are going to learn how to get a bill passed and how to create a bill, how to write a bill in that kind of language we've been talking about. And on this show today, we're asking you to think up, what kind of bill would you want to pass if you could? What would it say? What is the thing you want to fix that you think a law could actually help? We're also going to tackle the question of maybe we shouldn't be passing all laws. We got a note from Bob who says, there ought to be a law, the title of our program. That is the problem. So we'll ask Oliver Goodenough about that. Too many laws, just this sort of muddled lawmaking process, and maybe the question about getting government out of the way. If If you want to participate, call 1-800-639-2211 or post your best idea for a good law Vermont ought to pass or repeal on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're talking with Vermont Law School professor Oliver Goodenough about how the process of lawmaking works and how citizens can get involved in that process, or at least have a better understanding of it. He's facilitating the first ever Legathon at the State House this month. And if you want to share your great idea for legislation that would improve the economy, the environment, some other sector of Vermont, call 1-800-639-2211 and give us your best law, or post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. We got a note from Mr. Palmer's fourth grade class at Edmonds Elementary in Burlington, who says, "We're listening to your program right now. Our suggestion for a law is that we need to strengthen traffic safety laws. As children, we are at risk when someone doesn't drive safely, like texting while driving or passing recklessly. We think they should make penalties stronger." What do you think about that, Professor?
Well, what they're getting at is actually something that is often the case, which is that we don't necessarily need another law. We need to take the one that we've got more seriously.
Do we need to pass a law to get the law taken more seriously?
No, that's actually more a matter of the executive side of things. You know, whether it's the local sheriff, the deputies, or the state police. You know, they're the folks who are executing on this. And often, if we need a law, it might be to put more resources. One of the things that often gets in the way of enforcement is resources. We don't necessarily give as much support to the enforcers as we would want to see.
I was going to bring up that term. Unfunded mandate. That
there we go.
A
exactly.
Problem.
Exactly. We say, yeah, here are 17 more laws, and by the way, there's no more police or social worker or whoever it is who's supposed to be the intervention point for that. So one of the things we need to do is to understand how to marshal the laws we do have and enforce them with more efficiency. That would be a great thing to work on. Again, our government, I know, does a pretty good job of that here in Vermont, but we could always do better. And so whether it's that or the earlier email from someone who was saying we need to enforce our disability laws better. Again, that would be a question of not – they've already said we've got the law. We just need to enforce it better. And that's a little different from this question of what you do. I would also take just a minute, if I could, to say that most of our suggestions so far have been around things that shouldn't be allowed, although a couple of the suggestions have come in and said – by the way, why don't we allow? And that's actually a key piece in this legislative mix. Often we think of the law as preventing things, but the law can also enable things. For instance, Vermont has had significant success with the captive insurance program. A little technical, people kind of think of it as one of those dull out there sort of things, but it brings tens of millions of dollars in taxes to us and rather more than that in economic activity, all because we said, oh, by the way, let's let a company own its own insurance company, which gave access to the secondary insurance market, a bunch of fairly technical things. But that little piece of technical change, which was just giving permission to something that actually, if we thought about it, why not, was a key piece in letting some economic development go forward. So it's both what we prevent, it's what we enable, it's what we get out of the way of. That mix is an important one to keep in mind.
While we're talking about this idea of enforcement, we got a note from Max in the Northeast Kingdom who says, "I'd be curious to hear about some of the tipping points or relevant forces that would drive a proposed law into reality. Beyond public safety, I'd imagine there are implications as to whether a law is enforceable. But how about things like the cost of enforcement, both police force and judiciary, or the income related to fines imposed by a guilty party?" And Max wants to know, do you have any examples of laws that never came into being as a result of these kinds of challenges?
Oh, no, there's a good question. Every year in the legislature, I'm sure there are dozens, if not hundreds, of laws that don't come into being, partly because of some of those questions. One of the questions of a law that did come into being was the texting while driving piece that was brought up. Again, there was a question because there's a certain convenience aspect to that. There's a certain libertarian, you know, I can do what I want to. My children tell me I'm a Vermonter, I can do what I want to. So there's a kind of a streak of that in us. Was it worthwhile? And again, the data comes in. Part of this is being sensitive to actual data. The data comes in and really says, by the way, this is a bad idea. This is, you know, people driving.
The texting is a bad idea. Not the law.
No. The texting is a bad idea. And therefore, even though it's going to now require police to do some extra enforcement, here's one that really, really makes some sense to go for.
Although the elementary school students are saying they'd like to see it enforced even more strictly. They're not seeing that enforcement.
Well, there again, there's a problem. How do you enforce it? It's another one of those ones that is, you know, a little hard to know just who's doing what in a car like that as they go by. But I think then, in addition to external enforcement, another important piece is personal self-enforcement, which we need to keep in mind. And this is also is a limitation on law. There is not a policeman everywhere in the state of Vermont, thank goodness. And much of the time, enforcement comes from the fact that we, as citizens, take on board that that is a declaration that's been made. That's a bad idea. Don't do that. And so our own self-enforcement can be important. But that's also a limitation on what can get passed, because if you're requiring people to self-enforce, then the general population has to accept it and get on board. If they go, yeah, that's a bad idea. That's one of the ones that then you don't see getting put to much use.
Let's go to Richard calling in from Wells River. Hi, Richard. You're on.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
My comment is Wells River used to have a gas station, and a mile to the east was another gas station in Woodsville, and a mile west was P&H Truck Stop, and they sold gas. At one time, they were owned by three different entities, so you had competition. And then over the past few years, they all became under the ownership of Jiffy Mart. Jiffy Mart closed the Wells River store, and they have a non-compete clause that anybody who buys or leases the store has to buy gas from them. And, you know, that just limits competition, and, of course, nobody's interested in it. And I don't know how you get around that, but I know, you know, Plainfield, Vermont had the same problem. You know, and you hear in Chittenden County, a lack of competition, you know, creates high prices.
So Richard, you'd like to see get rid of a non-compete clause, make that a law that you can't have it? All right.
Yeah. So
what about that, Oliver Goodenough?
That's a very interesting question, because antitrust law clearly exists and is meant to support exactly that principle that competition is a good thing, will drive things down. It is rational for an individual business often to say, no, we're gonna take over this territory and we're gonna try and prevent others from coming in. At the federal level, there are laws, but most of those would not have direct application at this granular level for the antitrust rules. Vermont could come in and on its own, to the extent not preempted by the federal laws in this area, and say that kind of non-competition agreement might be just unenforceable. One of the things that actually California has done, not in the gas station world, but in the tech world, is that California has made non-competes unenforceable after someone leaves a company. So if someone leaves Google and goes to Apple, they can do that. Many other states will allow that to be prevented for a year or so, or a year or two. And if that's the case, then labor mobility decreases. And when labor mobility decreases, the whole market for intellectual exchange goes away. So again, exactly the kind of unenforceability of a non-compete that he's talking about here in the sort of consumer side is applied in the at the tech level in that kind of way. I would think that indeed some form of the law he's proposing might be very sensible.
We got a note from Chuck in Heartland, who has an idea for the issue we discussed earlier of Vermont Amazon Associates. And he says, in answer to the Amazon question, one answer would be to switch the sales tax from goods to services. Since the service economy is about three times larger than the goods economy, the sales tax could be reduced to 2% for the same tax raised and the tax on goods removed. Since Amazon doesn't sell services, the associates would be good to go. So, you know, one of the things that just pleases me so much about hosting this show is how smart and innovative and thoughtful our commenters are. They all often know so much and think so deeply about these issues. Oliver, one of the notes that I had mentioned we got, and I want to have your response on this, is Bob, who says that idea of there ought to be a law, that is the problem. You know, we're talking about laws and the good that they can do, but there's another perspective about too many laws, too much government. It's all about what law can you create? Just get the government out of it. And, you know, Bob didn't go into detail about what he sees as the problem, but he's saying this idea of let's just create a law to fix it. That's the problem.
And that's sometimes the case. I think that, that obviously there are many, many areas where an intervention on behalf of the public good is a good idea and a necessary idea. I think we also need to realize that often, not always, but often those interventions carry some drag with them. And so one of the questions is, can we diminish the drag while maximizing the public good? That's the assignment of the legathon, is that very, very hard question of can we figure out ways to go about that, square the circle? I don't think just getting government out of it completely is a good idea. I mean, obviously, there are places we need that. Now, you know, one of our principal political debates at this point in our country is where and what and how much and back and forth across that. And I'm not going to be able to solve those debates right now and then to observe they exist. One of the things I would mention, though, is that often a law, and I'm going to reiterate this, can be a catalyst as well as a difficulty. That our good nonprofit law makes nonprofit enterprise possible. Our good laws on social enterprise make social enterprise possible. Our good laws actually on corporations and that kind of thing make businesses possible. All of those are facilitated by law. I think it's important to remember that government is both a check on activity, sometimes absolutely appropriately so, sometimes perhaps not as cleverly or as appropriately as it might be, but also can be a place to make things possible. And so I would urge people when they're thinking about this kind of economic development and law question to think about what could we do that would actually make something possible and not just what could we do that would prevent something that we view as a harm.
Well, to that end, what are you actually hoping comes out of the Legathon, this event that prompted us to have this show where we talk about good ideas, because that is what you're supposed to be coming up with in just under 2 weeks at this event, is help people create model legislation so that they can understand the process, but presumably also create good model legislation that might be picked up. So what are you hoping comes out of it?
Well, all kinds of things are possible in this. In the last session, for instance, there was a discussion of a law that might enable some of the blockchain aspects to go forward. And there's a study committee happening on that, in fact, at this point. In addition to that, we could have, I mentioned earlier, the law of robots and autonomous agents. No state yet has a clear law to say, here's what would be the official and appropriate things they can do, and here are the things they couldn't. Clarity into that thing might be good. The maker economy is out there, the sharing economy. There's all kinds of stuff. Whether or not Uber could style approaches to the world is a good idea or not. The imagination of our attendees is exactly what I'm hoping to hear from.
So you're not steering them in one direction or another?
No. We want to hear broad, across all parties, across all ideas. You know, bring them on, and then work them. That's the point, is we're going to have the opportunity to work them with peers, with folks, with counselors from the legislature. Really put it to the test. And if it can survive the test, hey, that's pretty good. Maybe we should think about that.
So, Oliver, you wrote to us that lawmaking is difficult, and it really requires a certain set of skills, an understanding of the policy concerns, as well as an ability to balance the interests of the people who are involved and think about these potential unintended consequences, skills in drafting, stating the law in that language that's both clear to people but also very narrowly focused. I realize that you're married to a lawmaker, but it sounds like kind of a difficult task to elect lawmakers, particularly a citizen legislature who can do all that.
It is a daunting task. One of the things about the citizen legislature is they're also supported by some good professionals, whether it's a legislative council or the Joint Fiscal Office. They have career folks there. Also, for better or for worse, our legislature is sometimes a bit stable. So folks learn over time and get a little better. So we're lucky in that.
Oliver Goodenough is a professor at Vermont Law School. He's going to be facilitating the first ever Legathon at the State House over the weekend of November 13th through the 15th. It's a Friday evening and then all Saturday and Sunday kind of event.
Sunday morning.
Okay, Sunday morning. You can get out for the afternoon. We have more information on how you can participate. Go to vpr.net/Vermont Edition. Also, we're getting a ton of ideas on our page at vpr.net. Go to Vermont Edition and add your own idea of a law that you might want to pass if you could. We're loving all the ideas and the conversation that's happening around it. Coming up, our monthly book series for kids, Dorothy's List. This month, a nonfiction book about African-American sailors fighting for safety and civil rights in the U.S. Navy in the 1940s. You're listening to Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. In 1944, a disastrous explosion rocked a naval base in California called Port Chicago. The racially segregated Navy base had dangerous and unfair working conditions for African-American sailors there. After the explosion, a large group of sailors refused to return to work loading ammunition under the same dangerous conditions. They were tried for mutiny. Those men were called the Port Chicago 50. That true story is told in the book, The Port Chicago 50, by writer Steve Sheinkin, and it's nominated for Vermont's Dorothy Canfield Fisher Children's Book Award. Today in our series Dorothy's List, VPR's Amy Noyes visits 5th and 6th graders who've been reading the book. Before getting into the story, Sheldon Elementary School librarian Lynn Laufer transports the kids back in time with some help from Duke Ellington.
Don't mean a thing if you ain't got that swing.
In the mid-1940s, while some African Americans were redefining popular music, others had signed up to fight for freedom and democracy overseas in World War II. They volunteered to fight even though they weren't treated as equals here in the United States. In fact, even in the U.S. Navy, sailors were segregated and black recruits were only allowed to do menial jobs like laundry and loading cargo. Sheldon Elementary School students, like 6th grader Calla Bordeaux, had questions about the story for the book's author, Steve Sheinkin.
What inspired you to write this book?
We put Calla's question and questions from other Sheldon Elementary students to the author.
This is a really little-known story, even amongst people who know a lot about World War II and the Civil Rights Movement. And I came across this little-known story of this explosion in Port Chicago, California, and then the subsequent civil rights showdown. And I just got really drawn into it.
This group of young readers at Sheldon Elementary School got really drawn into the story as well. They were outraged by the prejudices black soldiers and sailors faced every day during World War II. It wasn't only the jobs that were segregated. Black and white recruits slept in different barracks. They stood in separate lines for food. And there were other examples of segregation and injustice.
Well, I thought it was outrageous in the book that they actually sort of separated the blood supplies from the white men or the black men.
And what I thought was outrageous in the book was that the African Americans went to jail for nothing. I mean, just because of their color on their skin.
When they started, like, arresting African American soldiers for not doing what they're told, even though they were scared.
Those comments were from students Grace Parrott, Hayden Dixon, and Cameron Scriver. Cameron wanted to know which part of the story was most upsetting to author Steve Sheinkin.
There were several things, but if I had to pick one, it was the racism in and around military bases faced by men in uniform and women in uniform as well in the U.S. The fact that we saw this with some of the Port Chicago men, that they would go off base and either face outright refusal to be served at a place like a bar, or they would have to walk through certain, quote, permitted streets, as if they weren't permitted to walk on certain streets in cities in the United States. And that is just outrageous. And meanwhile, they're wearing the uniform of the United States military at a time when the country is quite literally fighting for its freedom, for the freedom of its people and really the whole world.
Another thing that bothered Sheldon 6th grader Grace Parrott was the lack of safety the Port Chicago sailors had when they were ordered to load explosives onto warships.
They didn't even train them to handle bombs. They just said, oh, go on the ship and load some bombs. They didn't even show them how to even pick them up or anything.
Here, author Steve Sheinkin reads more about that from the Port Chicago 50.
The Navy never even gave the men any kind of written manual describing how to handle bombs safely. No such manual existed. Some safety regulations were posted on sheets of paper at the pier, but not at the barracks where the men might actually have time to read them. The officers didn't think the black sailors would be able to understand written regulations. They just brought you in and showed you, taught you a little something and turned you loose, remembered Freddie Meeks. I didn't know what to do, Morris Sublette later said, so we improvised our own ways. Yes, there were white officers who were supposedly supervising the work, but they didn't know any more of what to do than we did. It was a recipe for disaster. And civilian stevedores in the Bay Area were horrified. They never let a worker handle explosives until he'd gained years of experience on the job. The Longshoremen's Union offered to send trained loaders to teach the Navy recruits. The Navy never responded. From the moment they arrived at Port Chicago, most of the men lived in constant fear of a catastrophic explosion. 17-year-old Spencer Sykes was convinced he'd die at the base. Boy, I'll never make it back home, he thought as he worked. I'll never see my mom again.
Throughout the book, we hear from a lot of the men who served at Port Chicago. Sixth grader Nicholas Paquette asked how author Steve Schenken found his sources.
While collecting data, how did you track the people that actually survived it? How would you track and find them down for eyewitness reports?
Yeah, we're dealing with a story that is over 70 years old now. So most of the guys, as far as we know, actually all 50 of the men who were accused of mutiny, charged and convicted, as you know, of mutiny, are dead at this point. So I wasn't able to talk to any of them. I was able to talk to several of their family members.
But as Steve Schenken tells Sheldon's sixth grader Caller Bordeaux, he did find a book about Port Chicago 50 written decades ago by a University of California Berkeley professor named Robert Allen.
And what was great about that is that he, back in his college days, had actually met and interviewed many of the main figures in this story. And if he hadn't done that, their stories, the Port Chicago 50, their stories would be gone. But Robert tracked them down in a heroic bit of detective work, I think, and interviewed them. And a few years ago when I contacted him, he very generously shared those oral histories with me. And that was the main bulk of the research I did, because I was able then to tell the story through their words.
My favorite character in the book was Joe Small.
Fifth grader Hayden Dixon is referring to a charismatic man that many of the younger sailors look to for leadership and advice.
I have a question for you. Who is your favorite character and why?
I agree with you. Joe Small was the most compelling character in the book. With the other one I'd throw in there would be Thurgood Marshall, the young civil rights lawyer who took up the case and later became Supreme Court Justice and was more famous for that than by far than he is for his participation in this little-known story. But Joe Small, you know, it's just like writing a novel or a movie. You need great characters. And in nonfiction, you don't get to make them up. So you have to get lucky. And we were lucky with this story that there was someone so compelling as Joe.
From tracking down eyewitness accounts to poring over oral histories and news archives, writing a nonfiction story involves a lot of research. Sixth grader Grace Parrott says she thought the book was exciting, but she wondered if researching and writing it didn't get dull.
When you were doing your research, how come you never got like bored with writing it? Like, you know, like, oh, this is getting so boring. Oh, my eyes are killing me.
That's funny. I hear you. I do hear you. And I could be bored too by certain subjects, definitely. But the great thing about my job is that I get to pick my subject. So I did choose this and go in with eyes open saying, all right, I'm going to spend 2 years on this, so I better be interested. And luckily I am.
Steve Schenken says, rather than a boring project, he likes to think of research as detective work.
And it may sound like a nerdy sort of detective work, and it is. But that's really what it is to me. I look for clues. And so it's never boring because I just find one interesting story and then hope that there'll be a clue in that story that will lead me, almost like I'm looking for another suspect to interview, that leads me to another story. Usually it's a source, or it could be an interview, or it could be someone I try to track down and ask questions to. It might just be another book in another library, but it still kind of has that pattern of solving a mystery. And so that absolutely keeps me interested.
Realize it or not, these Sheldon students have been doing some pretty in-depth research of their own into what it was like for Black Americans during World War II. They've read two nonfiction books, Steve Schenken's Port Chicago 50 and Tanya Lee Stone's Courage Has No Color. That book tells the story of the Triple Nickels, America's first Black paratroopers. It was nominated for the Dorothy Canfield Fisher Award last year. With the help of librarian Lynn Laufer, the Sheldon students are using online resources to learn about civil rights and cultural heroes from Martin Luther King Jr. to singer Marian Anderson. And they're taking some encouragement from Billie Holiday as well to perhaps do some more research on their own. For VPR News, I'm Amy Noyes.
The book is The Port Chicago 50 by Saratoga Springs author Steve Schenken. Thanks to the readers and librarian Lynn Laufer at Sheldon Elementary School. Next month on Dorothy's List, Unfriended by Rachel Vale. Eighth grader Truly Gonzalez can't believe her luck when her ex-best friend invites her to sit at the popular lunch table, and she hopes her current best friend will understand. But before long, Truly doesn't know who she can trust at school or online, where it's even harder to know if people are who they say they are. Here's an excerpt from Unfriended.
My mom had said to be careful last night when I told her about being asked to sit at the popular table yesterday. I think she worries that popular girls are all secretly mean. I explained that the girls who sit at the popular table are actually the nicest girls in the whole 8th grade. Things were probably different when Mom was my age, and it was called junior high school. I've seen some of those movies. It's awful, and I don't just mean the hair.
That's a bit of Unfriended, read by Sheldon 6th grader Calla Bordeaux. It's nominated for the Dorothy Canfield Fisher Award, and it's next month's selection in our series, Dorothy's List. The series is sponsored by the VPR Journalism Fund. That's it for the day. Over the weekend, many people in Burlington became aware that KKK flyers had been left at the homes of two black residents of the city. One of them, Jocelyn Harvey, spoke at a police press conference on Saturday about first finding the flyer, then logging onto Facebook and finding out that someone else had also received one.
I initially thought it was a really horrible prank, but when it started to be their targeting, who knows how many people, that's when it became very scary.
Well, tomorrow on Vermont Edition, we'll talk about the flyers, questions about how the police responded, and the bigger issue of hate groups in Vermont. You can send your questions and comments, your reaction, to vermontedition@vpr.net, and join us tomorrow at noon. Our producers are Rick Singeri and Sam Gale Rosen. We have production assistance from Hannah Kearns. Mary Williams directed the program, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.